the cool thing about ZK rollups as compared to optimistic rollups is because ZK proofs are math, they are able to be applied on top of each other. So you can do a proof of a proof of a proof of a proof of a proof because it's all math. But you can't really do fraud proofs of fraud proofs of fraud proofs of fraud.
Hello everyone, and we are live. Welcome to the 16th episode of Colors of Web3 and Entrepreneurship. My name is Lum, your typical Web3 host, and today I am back to the Web3 world with Emily Lin, who is a developer relation at Linea, a smaller company inside of Consensus, which is one of the biggest company in the Web3 world. Emily, can you give a quick introduction about yourself?
Yeah, that's probably perfect, right? I'm Emily. I do developer advocacy for Linea. Linea, I guess you could say it more as like Consensus is bootstrapping Linea, right? So Linea is an L2. The ultimate goal, right, is to decentralize Linea. So for now, right, Consensus is helping out with, like, I guess, all the stuff that it takes to just bring up a chain and create an ecosystem. Yeah, but I guess this introduction about myself specifically, if you want to know other things about me, I play Dungeons and Dragons and I really like fried chicken. So my three personalities are Web3, D&D.
I like that. Okay, D&D and fried chicken. Maybe let's talk about your hobbies first then before we even talk about that. So can you share with us a bit more about D&D? I don't think I've played Dungeons and Dragons before.
So Dungeons and Dragons is a tabletop role-playing game, if that means anything to you, or means nothing to you, I guess I'll explain it really quick. Basically, it's a bunch of nerds get together, and I actually do the dungeon mastering part, so I'm the DM, but what you can imagine it as basically is collective storytelling. So I'll start off with a scene NPCs, and I'll play all of them. And then each of my players at the table have their own characters that they've created, backstories, etc., that interact with the world that I've created. And then D&D in general has like specific mechanics about, how successful or unsuccessful you are at certain things you do. It's completely open-ended. So an example would be like they encounter a king they want to get more information about. Like I would play the king maybe that they're talking to, and let's say in the background they have some idea that the king has done something evil. They can either like try to persuade him for information. So there's actually a mechanic specifically for persuasion roll. So they'll roll a dice to see whether or not they're successful or enough. You could threaten him, like put a knife to his throat or something like that. There's an intimidation check specifically as well. You can basically do whatever they want to do. And then my job as a DM is to decide, what skill they need to use in order to be successful or not. And then when it comes to like crafting the characters themselves, they all select their various stats and background and things like that. So if they want to be like a fighter or a sorcerer or et cetera, and each class you have also changes, how successful you'll be at a role, right? So you might be a sorcerer with high charisma stats. So if you have high charisma, then it's much easier for you to persuade someone versus someone who has very low charisma, which might be like a barbarian, for example. But I don't know.
I see.
It might have gotten more confusing as I explained it.
But so wait, is it actually, do you have a card or is there like pieces, like chess pieces? Do you move along the board?
Yeah. So it really depends. So if you play in person, like IRL, we have a giant kind of mat that is like a grid, and each kind of square represents 5 feet. So when it comes to like actual battle, there's very specific mechanics for that. And like your character can only move a certain number of feet per second, I guess. And then that determines, where you can put yourself and things like that. And you have like the little character pieces. They also have online formats as well. But for the most part, you don't actually play with the mat and the characters. It's usually just like I describe the setting, you walk around this area, whatever. It's only when it really comes to battle or it's really important that you know how far you are from a certain landmark that the actual pieces and Matt comes into play. Otherwise, we could have sessions where basically there's no battle or there's nothing that really matters with regards to needing to understand distance. So yeah, that's kind of where things come in. So
it's kind of like SimCity in a way. You can just build, you can like whatever way you like, right? Grow a city.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like Sims. You wouldn't necessarily like build towns and all of that because you're more of like adventurers in a city. So in order to build a city, you probably need a lot of money. So they would probably need to do a lot of adventuring and quests and everything to be able to find the money to build the city. I think like most recently our game is they were chasing a werewolf down a tunnel that was made by like a giant bug monster, took a wrong turn, and then ended up in a fire temple, which ended up being the gates of hell. And then if you exited it from a different door, you actually end up on a different continent, which is an island, which completely threw them off course because they were actually going on a quest to save a different town. But anyways, that's kind of an example of,
So when you play this in real life, you just have to imagine, right?
Because
like
I guess
there's no drawing, right? There's people don't draw things.
No. Like,
okay.
I mean, like sometimes I'll bring up a drawing because like Wizards of the Coast, who produces D&D or like creates the materials and everything, actually has pre-created monsters that you can like use to populate the world and everything. You can also create your own if you want, but those will come with illustrations. So I'll like bring that up and I'm like, oh, this is what this looks like, and things like that. But I could also create my own if I wanted or flavor it differently. Like it could be a giant. Like one example would be like, oh, if I there's stats for a wolf and there's stats for a spider, but say in my world there's actually a spider wolf, then I can like combine the two and like kind of manipulate it as I want as the dungeon master, and then
That sounds like fun. Maybe someday I would like to play someday just to get to know
the
game.
It's super fun. I really like it. I always like say if you want to play a game, like a beginner game, that's totally, I'm totally down to host. It usually takes 4 to 7 hours is the thing.
Wow, that is very long.
That's
like almost a full working day. Yeah. For some people. Yeah. Anyway, so about working day, can you give us, actually I'm quite curious about your Web3 journey. Maybe can you share with us like what you did before Web3 and how you got into Web3, you know, your professional background, leading up to your current position now.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question because I feel like everyone has very unique kind of journeys. So I would say I started off as like a pretty normal person in a sense. I was just like an engineer at a Web2 company. I did a bit of back-end and infrastructure development. I think at the time I realized that, you know, being a pure engineer was not what I was interested in. I wanted, like, wasn't even sure if I wanted to stay in tech, right? I was like, I want to work on something I love. And so my first thought was like, I love eating. Let me move into food. So as I was an engineer on the side, I actually started a beverage business. So if you guys are familiar with water kefir at all, that's like a fermented probiotic beverage. Actually, the first time I had it was in Malaysia. And I was like, wow, that was really good. And I brought it back to the States, found an incubator, sold it in a few grocery stores. And that was like, I guess I was planning on actually quitting my engineering job to go into this full time. But then the pandemic hit and I was like, I don't feel comfortable not having health insurance in the States. And then the other piece was also like, I was quitting my job because we had some like grocery deals coming to be lined up. But then they're like, oh, let's hold off to see until like when COVID ends. Obviously, COVID didn't end for like 2 years. But I think that was good because it gave me some time to reevaluate what I wanted to do, because like doing a beverage company was also very time consuming. And I also feel like I wasn't learning anything new in a sense, like new skills, I guess. But it was like food and beverage is a solved in like problem, essentially. Like you just need to find marketing and scale and then you're good to go. So it was kind of back to the drawing board of where do I want to land in terms of job. So it became
so
like two things.
You sold the company? afterward?
No. I didn't. It was definitely not in a place where I was able to sell the company. Hmm. Like, we were very small. I only lost money on that whole thing, right? Like, maybe I broke even. Like, side business. Yeah, I did it for a little under a year, like around a year. But where was I? Yeah, so essentially, I talked to my sister, who actually does developer relations in Web3 at Xerox Labs, if you're familiar with it at all. They're a DEX aggregator. And so I got talking to her about like what I was interested in and like what I wanted out of a career. And I think first off, developer relations is where I wanted to land, because I think it was actually a good kind of marriage of my technical background and my work at the beverage company. Specifically because one of my favorite parts of the job was just demoing in grocery stores and getting to talk to customers and figure out, you know, what did they like, what didn't like, what messaging landed with, like trying to explain product, like fermented drinks, combined with like the technical background that I already had. And the last piece was just like industry. And so that's when she was like, I always knew blockchain was a thing because she had always been interested in it. But then we were talking more about it and I was like, okay, this is really interesting because it solves that problem of like, I want to be in a place where I know there's really smart people working. There's like new things that no one, like problems that no one has figured out how to solve, right? And that's really cool. And then the third piece was like, I've never really been a DeFi degen. So like, I think early crypto wasn't something that I was super interested in. I mean, like, I think the use case, like I understood, but it wasn't immediately applicable for me. But kind of NFT summer came out and it was just a lot about data ownership and empowering creators. And that's something that really resonated with me of like, wow, this is really unlocking kind of new use cases. So if you're familiar with like projects like Mirror, for example, which is like a blogging platform where everything is an NFT. That was super cool because I actually have my own blog, right? And I think I'm always really paranoid now about like losing kind of my history of work too, which is kind of a dangerous place to be. So yeah, I think permanence and ownership of data and like things you create was what brought me into Web3 and like has kept me here.
Nice. So what year did you join Consensus?
2022. Hmm. Yeah. So March 2022.
Nice. And you've been doing developer relation with them since then?
I started out at the Truffle team. So if you guys aren't familiar with Truffle, they are a developer tooling suite for like building your smart contracts. So they're the very first one that ever existed, which was, I think, a really good opportunity for me in the sense that everyone I worked with was super OG. They've been in blockchain since like the beginning, were the foundations of like how developers interact with Web3. And so that was cool. And then I transitioned to Linea in March 2023.
I see. Yeah. I don't think I ever tried Truffle, but I think my first framework was like Hot Hat was a more common one.
Definitely.
I tried Brownie first. Brownie was the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, for me. And then I tried Hot Hat and now I switched to Foundry, which is
One, yeah. So, I mean, things are constantly developing, moving at a really fast pace. Actually, Truffle was deprecated recently just because, you know, trying to figure out, I think Consensus in general was trying to streamline where their business value and best ways to empower developers lie. So there's like bits and pieces of Truffle that still kind of exist throughout, but like as a full, like dedicated, I guess, product within Consensus, it has been deprecated and the team has been split up, which is like, I think just like one of the unfortunate things that comes with open source projects. Is like when you don't make money on anything, like how do you sustain, you know, a project without like a key sponsor behind it, donations.
Yeah. I think for open source projects, it needed to be a lot of volunteers, contributors of various types and Sometimes also financial sponsors as well.
Yeah. So I don't know. Foundry's nice because they have Paradigm behind them, which is like a lot.
Yeah.
And then when you think about like the biggest open source projects in Web2, like Kubernetes, for example, that's like Google. Yeah. So you got to have the big guys behind it.
That's true. I actually, if I remember correctly, I read a book on someone related. I think Kubernetes was actually an technologies was used inside Google, right? And then they open source it, right?
So that's how a lot of open source projects start, but
it's awesome. Well, actually, one thing I like to ask people who are in Web3 is like, what was your first thing that kind of got you into the Web3 space? Like, what was your first like memory about Web3, or how did you even know about Web3 in the first place? Was it Bitcoin? Was it something else? Or...
Yeah. I mean, so the very first time I heard about Web3 was definitely like the Bitcoin bull run in 2017, 2016. So I was in college at the time, university, and like definitely all my classmates were like aping in and be like, Emily, you need to invest, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, my mom says the S&P 500 is the best way to go. And that's what I'm going to do. But my sister was definitely like part of that movement. So she's been in pretty early on. So then when it came to like actually participating and making the leap into Web3, like I said, in the beginning, like NFTs, I think really landed with me. So like when we were talking about Decentraland, for example, so like I'm a DM, right? So these kind of like RPG games, or just like, I guess you could say online worlds that are very interactive, resonate with me from like a user standpoint of view, and like the interesting things they were doing with that in terms of like NFTs and digital collectibles was what kind of pulled me in, as well as like I want to kind of work in this sphere, and like that's another opportunity for me to interact and learn more about how technology is kind of combining with my personal interests. And I got really lucky, actually, because before I even hopped into Web3 fully, my sister just like brought me into the ZeroX Labs office, and I got to hang out with that team. And so they're also very OG. I don't know if they're the first X aggregator, but they're one of the first, and been around for a very long time. So again, being kind of seeped in people who are very knowledgeable about the space, super welcoming, actually helped. Not that they paid for, but I stayed with my sister in her hotel room for ETH Denver specifically. So before I was even in Web3 fully, nice. I got to go to ETH Denver for free. I mean, other than my plane ticket, and kind of feel the vibe and see how much new stuff is happening and the excitement around it, and all the cool, like, really smart people that are working on different things. Yeah, so that was kind of
was
my
this
first...
back in like 2018?
No, this was 2022, actually.
Oh,
so
okay.
This was like right before I joined Consensus. So I was like fortunate, I think, to just be able to get to a... Yeah. So, I mean, okay, to give you the full timeline, 2017 is when I heard about Bitcoin and all of that. And then 2019 is when I launched. So then 2018 is when I graduated and started my engineering job. 2019 is when I did the beverage business. And then I did that a little bit throughout 2020, and then 2020 through 2022, was just more so like internal transitions within my own company. So like that going from back end to infrastructure development, I actually picked up project management internally as well. So that's when I kind of started to foray into not being just only coding, but also like not interdisciplinary, but like connecting with teams outside of my own engineering team. And then 2022. Or let me start over. 2021 is when I started being like, okay, I need to figure out something else. And I was talking to my sister. And then I'm very much a New Year's resolution person. So I was like, when the new year comes, I'm going to start applying for jobs. And so 2022 happened January 1st. And I was like, okay, you know, send out applications everywhere. And Consensus was like nice enough, I guess, to hire me without any Web3 experience, which was really cool. Also no developer relations experience either, but they've trusted me, and I feel like I hope I'm good at my job.
Sure the software engineer experience would count a lot, right? I mean,
it's a piece of it.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah, that paint the full timeline. Yeah, actually, without further ado, would like to maybe deep dive a bit into both of your companies. Please feel free to share, maybe walk us through your main company first, Consensus, and then maybe talk about Linea, and then
So I guess, is this where you would want me to pull up
yes,
the
feel
sites?
Free to share any websites that you have at this time.
Cool. So if you want to learn more about Consensus, this is consensus.io is kind of where you would go. This is our new branding. I think we rebranded last year. But anyways, Consensus is like a pretty big OG in the space. So our founder, Joe Lubin, was actually one of the Ethereum co-founders. He broke off and started creating, like started a, like a, I don't want to say company, I guess a company. We called it this hub and spoke kind of process where he was just funding a bunch of people, just building different things, figuring out what sticks. This is super early Ethereum.
It's famous, yeah.
yeah. And then decided to create, and a few things landed. So we actually have a lot of different products, both for developers and for kind of user-facing things from like every part of the stack, right? So we have like Beizu, Teku. So these are open source node or like clients. So similar to, I think Beizu, I forget how much they capture a significant part of the running. So you have like Geth and like, I forget the other ones, but like, Beizu is one of them. If you guys are familiar, like from the developer side, we have MetaMask for developers actually. So there's SDK, Snaps, which recently came out. So that's similar to like creating an extension of MetaMask. So now MetaMask can support like non-EVM chains, for example. People can like interrupt transactions and do analysis before things like commit. Diligence is the smart contract auditing arm. Infura provides RPC nodes. And then MetaMask, most people know from like a user perspective as the entry point for like self-custodial wallets, right? And then that extends also into like MetaMask portfolio, if you guys don't know it either, which is more, again, on the user side, creating a really integrated view of how to interact with Web3 products from a user point of view in a self-custodial way. And then last piece, we launched Linea mainnet last July 2023. And so that is kind of our latest thing that we've put out, which is a ZK rollup L2. But yeah, I mean, Consensus has done a lot of different stuff. We actually have an internal like research and development arm, which has done a lot of really interesting things. Unfortunately, not everything has come to light because you got to figure out like what makes sense and what doesn't. But Linea was actually one of those things that was born out of research departments. So research departments figuring out like what private data is like. Right. And so they were doing ZK research back in like, 2018-ish, and then through that process realized like, hey, the types of like ways that we're doing like zero knowledge proof is actually really good for scalability, like scaling solutions. So then that's kind of when they pivoted into L2s and what does ZK look like for L2. So they started on it pretty early on while people were still exploring optimistic solutions. But yeah, that's Consensus.
Absolutely. How many people working at Consensus?
Working at Consensus, I mean, last time I checked, it was like 700. We might have grown to like 800 or something like that. I'm not sure. But yeah.
It's a
big company. Yeah. We're not public yet. So I don't know if that means we're still a startup, but it feels very like big.
No, but for sure, Consensus is one of the OG. I mean, I remember Joe Lubin is one of the founders. I think he joined Ethereum back in like 2014 or something like that, right? There was a book. There was even a book written about the Ethereum founders that I read. Yeah.
Very fascinating book.
Actually, what I like about your website, the main web, the Consensus website, they have like numbers on here, right? So people can know like the impact. Like if you go here, you see here, MetaMask user connected dApps, and then when you go down, like the other one also have some of the numbers over there, too, just to give people some skills. Yeah.
Yeah.
2T, I believe that's like 2 trillion. That's a lot of transaction or whatever. What's the unit here? Request. 2 trillion. That's very huge. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Infura.
And Linea.
A lot of really exciting things happening. And Linea. I don't know how updated these numbers are, but yes.
Yeah. Must be quite new. Yeah. Can you walk us over your main company now, Linea?
So Linea is bootstrapped by Consensus. They are we're a ZK rollup, right? So launched in, but testnet was like, private testnet was end of end of 2022. Public testnet was March 2023, I think, and then mainnet was July 2023. I guess to start from the beginning, I don't know what the expertise of this, like, your cohort is, but essentially we are a scaling solution on Ethereum. The way rollups work is essentially they roll up transactions, execute them off chain, and then post that data back on Ethereum, called like data availability for security purposes. So like all that information is secured by Ethereum versus something you would think about like a side chain like Polygon proof of stake, where that lives in a completely different side chain, and you don't have that communication back onto the Ethereum layer. So rollups was kind of the landed agreement in the Ethereum community of like, this is where we want to go with scaling. The second piece, like evolution, was how do we, verify that this information is correct, right? Because we want to post this data back, and so that's kind of where the proofs came in, right? So we have the optimistic rollups, which basically wait 7 days and give people the opportunity to say like, hey, this looks fraudulent, and then they submit a fraud proof to check whether or not it's true or false. ZK rollups was the next iteration of that, where it was essentially like, hey, rather than verifying via just like, I guess, consensus, right, let's verify using math, which is far more secure, right? So basically creating a proof of correctness that these transactions are the way that they are, posting that back on the data, and you have to verify that the proof is correct on the L1, right?
I see.
So this is what like ZK rollups do. With regards to like Linea specifically, I think it differentiates itself in a few different ways. So the first part is like from the developer point of view, we are a type 2 ZK EVM. So just to kind of quickly summarize, it's really difficult to translate code into something that math can understand, like polynomials and a proof and everything. So different rollups have taken different approaches to it. So I would say like type 4 ZK EVMs are essentially the farthest away from the EVM spec. What that allows them to do is maybe be more flexible with different implementations. But as a developer, you're going to have to like develop a you have to develop a separate plugin specifically for like Foundry, for example, to understand ZK Sync. Right, because it's not like a one-to-one translation, whereas something like Linea or Scroll or Polygon ZKVM, we're in the type 2 world where it's like we're basically exactly bytecode equivalent. So when it comes to developer tooling and you trying to understand how the rollup works, it's exactly the same. So it's basically every type of ZKVM you can write in Solidity, but then the interpreters, the bytecode side, will differ depending on whether you're a type 4 or type 2. And then type 1 is exactly EVM equivalent. So what that means is more so like how data works. We don't have to get into that. Well, that's like from the developer side. From the user side, I think the biggest piece that really sets Linea apart is the way our connection within consensus, right? So like consensus has a lot of influence, especially through MetaMask. Linea kind of gets to fit into that whole like ecosystem of things. So like MetaMask has a default network in its dropdown with Linea there already, right? So I think I see this very much as a user security like improvement, in the sense that users, you know, especially new entrants to Web3, have a lot of anxiety about what it looks like to click add a network. So if you're like on a different chain, you actually have to bring that into MetaMask. You don't know if that's actually going to drain your funds or not. Whereas Linea is specifically already within MetaMask. So the trust you give to MetaMask is inherited by, like, therefore Linea also inherits that trust and provides that security with regards to not having to like click random buttons to be able to transact on certain applications. So that's really cool. I mean, if you want to talk about like proofs and all of that from like the technical perspective, we can do that as well. I personally think that doesn't matter as much, because at some point, you know, as long as the cheapness is there, the speed is there, really it's all about experience from both the user side and the developer side.
The first time I actually heard about like type 1, type 2, and type 4 ZKVM rollup, that's actually quite interesting. So I mean, I've read a lot about, there's two main type of rollup on Ethereum, right? One is optimistic and one is like ZK. Can you maybe share with us, like, what's the differences, main differences between optimistic and ZK rollup?
Yeah. So I actually have slides for this, so I can
perfect.
Sure, bring that up. Let me see if I can find. Okay, I'll share my slides again.
Okay.
I'm not going to present, but I've given this a few times. But essentially, right, the biggest piece right here with optimistic rollup. So like I said, with rollups, you have to post that data back to Ethereum for security, right? So you always have that information in history of transactions. But how do we know what we're posting is correct? So optimistic rollups do something called a fraud proof. So when they before they post the data and like finalize it on the L1, which is Ethereum, they do an optimistic or a fraud proof where there's like consensus mechanisms, like slashing mechanisms. I don't know the full details, but essentially like someone can go in and point like this looks fraudulent. And then that's when they check. So you optimistically assume everything is correct and wait for external members to challenge it. Right. And that's why there's that 7-day challenge period. I wrote here trusted bridges are a workaround. So specifically, it's like if you're trying to settle your Ethereum from like your Ether from Optimism back to Ethereum, like from the canonical bridge, you're going to have to wait 7 days. There's other bridges where like they'll just have their own liquidity pools and be able to give you that return that, I guess, Ether back to you immediately. But we know bridges are the biggest target for hacks. So that's kind of a problem. Also, NFTs are not like transferable through like a bridge. So there's that piece as well. But the other thing would be ZK rollup. So that was kind of the next step in it. So like I said before, it was fraud proofs. And then we said, okay, rather than fraud proofs, let's use math because math is going to be the most secure. It's like unopinionated basically. And so that is what it's called a validity proof. And there's basically a separate verifier contract on the L1. So when you submit, when you submit the data back to the L1, there's a rollup contract that stores all of the information. But then with zero knowledge rollups, there's a separate contract that's like knows how to take a proof and basically spit out true or false. They don't need a challenge period because you're just using math to verify. And then the other piece I think I wrote here as a common misconception is I get a lot of like, oh, Linea is a privacy solution because it has zero knowledge in it. Like that's false. That information is like all still there, right? It's not private. We have settled on ZK proofs as the best mechanism for validity proofs because it allows us to submit a proof with as little data as possible, right? So ZK rollups have, or ZK proofs have the property of not having to reveal all the information. So this is actually the cheapest way to do a validity proof because with when it comes to gas and how rollups, like, I guess, you where costs come in from, the actual execution on the L2 is incredibly cheap. But what's very expensive is actually the data that you're putting back on the L1 and the verification, right? So like, again, the most expensive part is from Ethereum. And you have to interact with Ethereum to be a rollup. So in the efforts of putting as little data as possible, we landed on ZK proofs because that's the smallest like mathematical proof that would make sense in this case. So that's a bit of the difference. So what you could say is like more secure, faster finality, which is like the word for how quickly it settles on the L1 with regards to the data being posted. With regards to that, right, not having that challenge period allows for more flexible liquidity within the market and things to flow. But yeah.
I see. Absolutely agree. Yeah. Going back to Linea, you know, one thing I've seen a lot in 2023 is that there's a proliferation of L2s, right? So there's so many L2s and even L1 too, even like the number keep increasing, but I think L2 now is more and more. So like, what is there something that makes Linea special? But I mean, I know that Linea is connected to MetaMask. So I think that's one of the big, huge advantage, right? Yeah, like you said, it's the increased trust and security. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a question I get a lot as well, right? I think the first thing I want to say is there should not be any one L2, right? We need multiple L2s just because, like, I think for the first part is, like, I don't think one L2 could also support the entire, like, transaction volume and speed of, like, the entire world if we were to get to that space, right? The other piece with regards to why we need multiple L2s, and I'll talk about Linea later, but just, like, when we talk about proliferation of L2s, that's a good thing, is variety of prover implementations. So this is super far out and actually very technical, difficult. So who knows if it'll actually happen. But one of the dreams and, like, important things to think about is if you transact exclusively on one L2, you are also centralized to their prover implementation, right? So if there's a bug in Linea's prover, then you're kind of screwed because you're reliant on Linea's tech. Whereas there's a theory or, like, a move or a desire for something called multi-prover theory, which is basically when it comes to that data settlement and proof verification, we should actually have multiple prover implementations, right? So getting more so a consensus of truth across, like, Linea, Polygon ZKVM, and Scroll, right? So if there's, like, a failure, then that indicates, like, somebody has a bug. So the first piece is, like, yes, we need a lot of L2s. This proliferation is actually a really good thing. As for how many L2s we need, I can't put that number out there. But I think for Linea specifically, yes, to, like, why you would want Linea or, like, deploy Linea, especially in these early stages where there's just so many to kind of pick from. And it is, like, a resource add to support multiple chains, right? Is, again, like I said, from the first piece, like, I think from a developer point of view, the biggest thing for, like, having your application survive is you need users, right? Like, it doesn't matter how cool the technology is in the background. It is, unless you have people transacting, spending money, and, like, interacting with your application, you're not going to be successful. And so that's where, like, the Linea MetaMask kind of partnership is a really big value add, right? When we think about MetaMask has 100 million users, right? That's, like, 100 million users who have direct access to Linea and, like, other ways that, you know, that kind of relationship can grow. I do want to take a step back and again say, like, MetaMask is not fully Linea. Like, I think MetaMask, what do you call it, has, I don't know what the word is for, but they want to be, like, credibly neutral, I think is what it is. So it is important to, like, be able to explore the whole ecosystem, not be locked into a single chain. But regardless, from, like, just because we are within the same company, it offers a lot of areas for collaboration as well as resources to leverage from, like, the MetaMask Linea handshake thing, right? And then again, like I said, like, Linea within the different L2s, the ZK rollup, specifically a type 2 ZK rollup, which is also special amongst the ZK rollups. If you want to talk about, like, how we do proofs differently, like, our proofs specifically, we have a kind of two-step prover system. So the first being we have a inner proof, which is basically using something called lattice-based proofs to recursively make data smaller and smaller and smaller, finally wrapped outside in something called an outer proof, which is going to be a Planck proof. So for all of the rollups in general, I think, I don't want to say because I haven't done a lot of research, they mostly just only do the Planck proof or, like, some variation on it. But, like, Linea is the only one with, like, this two-step recursive system. So that gives us a lot of flexibility, I think, with regards to, like, making things smaller, better, stuff like that in the future. But yeah, again, like I said, I think from a developer point of view or an entrepreneur point of view, like, that's cool. But unless there's, like, people spending money on your application, like, it doesn't really matter. So yeah, I think that's where Linea stands apart. I think I want to say, like, two things about us in terms of, like, narrative, of what I think we are really focusing on is two pieces, right? Like, first part is, like, security, right? So ZK security, also, like I said, the MetaMask security from the directing users in the correct place to go, not get scammed. And then the other piece is, like, Linea ultimately is block space. So I think for us, we take a very partner first strategy. So everything we do and interact with regards to our dApps is, like, figuring out how to amplify them through our channels, right? We have, like, I don't know, over 800,000 Twitter followers, and then also just like the consensus, what do you call it, consensus brand as well, like giving dApp developers opportunities to access that kind of leverage and spread is super important, especially for early projects. So yeah, I think we're a very partner first, security first kind of roll up is how we see ourselves.
I see. So basically there's no specific application type, right? Are there any notable application on the ecosystem for Linea?
Yeah. I mean, so like the first piece I think is like Linea is really focusing on DeFi. DeFi, I think we also see as infrastructure, because in order for a network to work, you need liquidity and like that kind of stuff happening on the network. So that's like kind of your standard, like yield farming, aggregators, DEXs. After that, I think what we are really thinking about as what's moving the needle on Web3 is like more consumer use cases, such as like social and gaming, right? So we had a app launch, I don't know, it was sometime last year. So it's called Tomo, T-O-M-O Social. It is a Frentech clone, but it's that plus like a lot more interesting things on Linea, which is really cool. They don't just do, if you guys aren't familiar with like Frentech or Tomo or anything, it essentially allows you to buy. Are you familiar?
I'm familiar with Frentech. I have not used it though, but yeah, it's on Base, right?
Yeah. So it's on Base. So I guess if your listeners aren't familiar with it, it's just like you can buy keys to sit in private rooms with your favorite influencers or things like that. But then Tomo takes a different angle of like not only that, but incorporating actual content and feeds and stuff like that on it. And I don't remember, like the UX is also really interesting. I think they're doing some stuff with like account abstraction and things like that, that's making the like experience of using Tomo a lot more accessible. So that's kind of like a breakout app that gained a lot of popularity when they launched last year. But yeah, I don't know, a lot of different things happening in the space. Like I said, we're block space, so whatever lands, right? We're not out here, we're not kingmakers, I guess you could say. Say like you're gonna win and be better than everyone else. It's like, no, we're gonna give everybody, I guess, equal opportunity to like how we leverage our resources for you. Because anything could be a killer app. I don't know if that's an overused term at this point, but like yeah
could be a bit. One thing I'm quite curious about is, you know, one of the trends that I see, or maybe one of the narrative this year that I see, that'll be more have to do with like data availability. Does Linea solve any of that problem, data availability? Because I think that's one of the areas where a lot of the blockchain need to solve, right?
Right. So data is actually the most expensive part within our like gas. So there's like different pieces of like how we calculate gas, from like the verification to data to like other things on top of it. But yeah, like data is a significant part of it. But that's actually what's really exciting about, I think it should be coming end of March, is the Denkun upgrade of Ethereum. So specifically EIP 4854. So as a quick summary of like what this is it's actually structuring, creating a new, I guess, data structure called blobs on each block, right? So what this allows us to do is separate out the data posting to Ethereum, not into call data, which is going to live on the blockchain forever, but temporary like blob space that has its own fee structure. So I guess to dive into why that's cheaper, right, is because you're only competing for this blob space, which is going to be like you're not going to be, I guess, beholden to the fluctuations of Ethereum, right? Because you're in a different fee market. A lot of fewer people are competing for that space. It's going to be significantly cheaper. The other piece to it as well that makes this blob space different is we are only posting data for like verification of truth, right? No one's going to be like checking on this forever, because, you know, things are always moving over time. So this blob space is actually also ephemeral. So I don't remember the exact number, but it will get cleaned up, so as opposed
pruned,
to
right? it'll be pruned. Time. No.
Yeah. Prune is the word. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of the solution that's coming up And it's going to make a huge difference for like every L2, like not just Linea, which is exciting. I mean, there's like other data availability solutions that are coming out, like EigenLayer and things like that. I'm not super familiar with like how it works. But, I mean, but Linea is not leveraging EigenLayer right now. Like we are just full speed ahead on figuring out like compression techniques, as well as, you know, waiting for Denkun to happen.
Sounds like a lot of mathematics underway, right?
Yeah.
Because I think earlier when you mentioned like recursive and then what is it, outer proof? I mean, in my head, I was already thinking like, okay, there's some recursive mathematics in there. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Happening.
So, I mean, that's the cool thing about ZK rollups as well as compared to optimistic rollups. Right, is because ZK proofs are math, they are able to be applied on top of each other. Right, so you can do a proof of a proof of a proof of a proof of a proof because it's all math, right? But you can't really do fraud proofs of fraud proofs of fraud proofs of fraud, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's a lot more opportunity for scale for ZK rollups as opposed to like optimistic rollups long run.
No, let's maybe. Actually, I'm quite curious about more about your job. You know, before I came into Web3, I was working as a data scientist. So I like numbers. Can you maybe give us a breakdown and percentage of your time spent on a daily or weekly basis? Like what you do as a developer relation so people would have a good idea?
That's a horrible question because every day for me is different. Also, like everything I do is different, right? I could say, like, categorically, I run a weekly developer workshop every Tuesday for 1 hour.
Okay.
So I guess in a 40-hour week, 1/40th of my time is spent doing that live stream specifically, right? But then otherwise, like, outside of that, I think it really depends. Especially, I think, like, developer relations in general is a very different type of job for every product that you're working on, right? So developer relations for Linea is very different than like when I was like DevRel at Truffle or like DevRel for an SDK, for example. Because like from a developer point of view, right, with Linea as well, the most important thing that we already have covered, right, is, you know, deploying your smart contract on Linea is exactly the same. Right. And then it becomes more so how do we empower developers and create an ecosystem around it? So my time has shifted a lot more to, I guess you could say, like community building developer evangelism versus like actual like coding day to day. But that's just because like I've switched roles. It's like some people are like 40% coding, 60% other stuff. For if you're like a very technical kind of product, like an SDK or an API or something like that, versus Linea, where I said again, you know, I think the success of Linea and our developers on there is very, very much focused on like how do we launch and support you on mainnet, right? How do we make sure you feel loved and like all the ways that are important for growing your influence. And so I do that via a various, like, so my developer, I guess, relations journey now is focused more on like, what does our hackathon strategy look like in kind of like a twofold way, both from like doing hackathons to test our product as well as find new developers who are just building interesting, like I met you at a hackathon, for example.
Yes.
But then the other side too is like we're exploring ways of like how do you do joint bounties or things like that with tools who are already on Linea, right? Like how do we amplify the infrastructure and applications that have been built on through those kind of avenues. Separately, I've also gotten a lot more into event throwing. And I don't know how much of this is because that's part of the DevRel job or like I just am horrible at saying no. So I do a lot of stuff like outside of my job as well. So it's more like how much of a percentage of my time is dedicated to DevRel to how much of a percentage of my time dedicated to like supporting other teams or like projects at Consensus. And I think a lot of that, again, is because Linea is an ecosystem. Right. I think focusing purely on Linea, for me at least, is I think a losing situation because Linea is we're just a chain, right? It's not as important as like all the other things that come on top of building the chain of like dApps that users want to interact with or like developer tools that developers want to use with and things like that. I didn't give you any numbers. I'm sorry. The only concrete number I can give you that I do every single week is the 1/140th of my time. I actually work more than 40 hours a week, but like, let's pretend like I have work-life balance.
Yeah. We all have work-life balance, right?
And then I don't know how long this podcast is. 1/40th of my time is spent doing things like this with you.
Oh, okay. That's awesome. But yeah, this is also, I mean, one way to, you know, get more people to know about Linea also.
Yeah.
It sounds like you actually get to do a quite variety of a different part of your job, right?
Which part would you say
is like your favorite?
Which part is my favorite? I think, again, going back to my beverage days, at first we're just like getting to talk to people, right? Like, getting to, I guess, one part spread the word about Linea, but also just like hear about all the cool things that are happening in the space. Like, I'm very fortunate from like a Truffle side as well as a Linea side that we very much sit at infrastructure level. So like, I get exposure to every vertical. Whereas if I was working like on a DEX product, for example, and mainly interact with like DeFi projects. I don't remember what the question was, but what do I like the most? Yeah. I think it's just like getting to talk to different people, find out what they're building and things like that. I think it used to be travel, but I hate travel now.
Oh, really? That's surprising.
When you travel too much, I'm just like, I want to be in my bed, in my own bathroom and like things like that. I don't know. I'm a huge fan of public speaking too. It's like kind of my bread and butter. So like doing workshops and like creating that and figuring out how to translate things into a digestible way is like a really fun part, I think, of my role that I like.
So you do some writing as well, right?
Yeah, I do some writing. Like not as much as I used to anymore, like I said, because I focus a lot more on amplifying other people. But like on occasion, right, like creating content and writing or workshops really is more so where I go to do things. So like creating slides, presentations, like videos and stuff like that.
Nice.
That's where I sit.
So besides, you know, lack of time, which I'm sure we all suffer from, what are the other challenges that facing maybe, you know, your role in particular, or maybe your team at Linea?
Sorry, you cut out a bit. What challenges are facing?
Oh, yeah. What challenge do you face in your current job and also in your team?
Yeah. So, I mean, from like my current job perspective, and I think that you could say this categorically across all developer relations, is just like lack of definition and a very high split of time, right? I think the thing that I miss about engineering, like we could talk about specifically, is you kind of work on the same thing and are really able to hone and focus all your time on a specific craft or project or stuff like that. But like for me as DevRel, you do everything, right? So I do a little bit of documentation. I do a little bit of support. I do a little bit of community building. I do a little bit of content creation. Like my time is very spread out. And unfortunately, I'm not the best at multitasking. So it's like this weird problem of like, I like doing lots of things, but I'm also not the best at doing lots of things. But no, I'm playing. I think I'm good at my job. Yeah. I think it's you do a lot of everything, which is both a good and a bad thing, right? So you really develop skills across a lot of different disciplines, but you don't necessarily get like the expertise of doing one single thing for the rest of your life. I think the other part really, again, with like DevRel as well as stakeholder management, which I find very difficult sometimes too, because everyone has a different opinion of what DevRel is supposed to be doing. That gets hard. So that's kind of what's difficult, but ultimately like I find it very exciting and like it stimulates your brain, I think, having to work in a lot of different directions. As for Linea specifically, like challenges, I think again, or like I think from like a technical perspective, it's hard to do. Like things are still expensive moving forward. But like for me, I think as a DevRel within Linea, again, the thing that's really hard is like almost like Linea is too much to do. I think one part is, unfortunately, at Consensus, like I'm kind of the only I am the only DevRel responsible for Linea, right? So whereas Linea sits within Consensus versus something like ZK Sync, which is its entirely own company on its own. They probably have like a bajillion dev rels. So in terms of workload, it's a lot harder. But I mean, the other piece is like, chains are big. There's like, my job is to support dApp developers, and it becomes hard where I'm like, oh my god, there's like over 200 projects that I'm interacting with that are looking for my time and stuff like that. And so like I talk about, I run developer workshops, and I have had workshops planned. Like last year I was like, they're like, oh, I would love to run with you, Emily. Like I was like, yeah, okay, cool, I'll pencil you in for March. And that's kind of the problem of like, I can't like overexpose people where I'm doing something every single day, right? Like no one wants to watch a dev workshop every day. But at the same time, it's like, how do I find shorter, more like frequent ways to engage and amplify with that many people? Yeah, in like a timely manner, right? Because I hate being like, yeah, I can hang out with you X months from now.
Yeah,
people need to move fast, right?
Yeah, so it's true.
It's a good problem to have, I guess. Yeah.
One thing I found that might help is it's media. You know what I'm doing. Not trying to toot my own horn, but I think media have some sort of amplification power as well too, with helping. Actually, to be honest, I learned a lot of like the coding from Patrick Collins, you know, coding bootcamp. You probably have seen it.
Yeah, I've participated in it as well. It's amazing. Very thorough.
It's super thorough. It's super amazing. I think it's also helped me a lot in that too. Yeah, which I think bring us to some general discussion about Web3. I think from your perspective, what is stopping developers from coming and building into Web3?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like two things, right? The first piece is just more so like use cases that resonate across all developers. You know, people are looking for, I think a lot of people want to work with things that they know and understand. And unfortunately, from like an educational perspective, or just like also a pop culture perspective, is either not known about at all or has like a very narrow scope of like what people understand. Especially I think with like scams and other things that are kind of not the most tasteful first introductions. So just from like a developer looking at what industry that they want to go in, unless they have learned about the value prop of Web3 from like the actual, like a reputable source versus what they just see in the media, that is like probably like one big barrier. The other piece I think that has been difficult, and it's improved a lot actually over the years, like since I've started, which is fantastic, was like, say I'm a developer that actually onboards into the system, just in terms of like the educational resources of like, how do I build, like how smooth is my developer experience, has been hard, right? Like dev tooling in the beginning has been very kind of not the best, but it's improved over time, right? In terms of educational materials too, there's like really great things like Patrick Collins Bootcamp, right? But it's definitely not as prolific as like tutorials on how to build with Next.js, right? There's like pretty limited exposure there. I think also because it is still like a very, like, and because you have fewer educational resources in that regard for developers, there's also fewer educational resources that are translated, right? So unless you're mostly like if you're an English speaking developer, then yeah, it's much more accessible for you, right? But if you don't speak English, that's like another barrier to entry with regards to like, okay, yeah, I'm interested in Web3. There's like huge use cases for like my specific country, for example. But then now I'm like trying to learn how to actually build, and like the developer tooling is not as like robust as what I have in Web2 with regards to like writing smart contracts and things like that. And then the second piece is like, if I want to learn, it's mostly all in English. There's some pretty high barriers to entry when you're at like the kind of early stages that we are right now.
That is true. And, you know, I've read some materials in other languages. I've met some actually developer who translate things into like Spanish, into Vietnamese, also for other communities around the world. Right? It's all like community effort, but usually it lags behind the English version, because usually the official version come out right in English.
Right, and people translate. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I know what you mean. Yeah. Interesting.
Just wait for Google Translate to get better. I think that's the.
Yeah. Well, but now we have like OpenAI, right? ChatGPT.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You can also use that too. Yeah, it helps a lot. Yeah. Okay. So, well, that's from the developer side. But now, what you want to ask one about for the user side in general. So, what can we as developers or developer relation in general do to onboard 1 billion people into Web3?
Yeah. I mean, 1 billion people, I think, is like twofold, right? Like, you have to find an application or like a use case that resonates with 1 billion people, right? Because if we think about Web3 from like a purely financial perspective, that's not 1 billion people. I mean, like within, I think, more established countries that don't experience
hyperinflation
and things like that, it definitely is perceived, and I don't know if you agree with this, but I feel like it's often perceived more as like a security or like a stock kind of thing, like an investment versus an actual unit of currency within like those countries, such as like the US, for example. And so like for landing like the entire US population, right, you need to find something that is going to be accessible and like interesting for like people across all kind of demographics, like whether or not you participate. Like, I don't even know how many people participate in like investment and like stock options in the first place, right? So that's kind of like one thing, and I think why people are really gravitating towards social and gaming as like a very accessible, understandable way of like why Web3 matters. And then the other piece is like, actually, there is quite a bit of adoption with regards to like it as a unit of currency externally. Like in Turkey, you do see Bitcoin. Like BTC Twerk, I think, is like everywhere, and like the actual kind of media translation of "I got my paycheck and I'm going to put it in Bitcoin" has been pretty popular and high adoption. So I think one piece would be like amplification, right? Of like, hey, people are actually using Bitcoin like as a unit of currency. Like there is value. Like even I know, like I tell my US friends about like these use cases in like Turkey and other countries, and they're like, oh my god, I can't believe it has that kind of adoption. That's insane. But they're like, but I'm never going to use it. And then I'm like, okay, well, I hang out with a lot of creatives, right? And I'm like, okay, well, what about NFTs, ownership, IP, stuff like that? And then that like resonates with them, right? So I think it's like not even landing one specific use case, but specifically finding multiple use cases that can cover the diverse interests of 1 billion people, right? No. And so I think that's one piece of it. But then like the second piece, I think the first and foremost, people always talk about like UX, right? No. Like if it's hard to use, then no one's going to use it. Like self-custodial wallets are difficult, right? With regards to like keeping your secret recovery key. And like in terms of people understanding how to be safe when interacting with Web3, because it's so like, I guess, individually driven, the fear or capability of being scammed and stuff like that is higher, I think, right, than what has been able to be battle tested over a very, very long period of time, like products in Web2, right? So there's that element of it, of like you can't have 1 billion users without like the majority of them feeling safe when interacting with it, as well as creating a safe experience, right? So, I mean, that's why, you see a lot of, I think, account abstraction getting really big right now with regards to like UX and things like that. And then after that, like security first. I will also say, actually, part of it is just making sure that everyone has access to the internet, which is also not necessarily a thing that exists across like all countries, and it's kind of like a thing that goes hand in hand, right? I would say, like, not that I'm from those countries, but like I would imagine places that experience hyperinflation and like really need Web3 as that key use case for like currency right now, right? How strong and reliable is their access to internet and like actual phones and like these kind of technologies that you are required to have in order to interact with like crypto, right? So there's a variety of like different things that have to be solved. I don't think there's like one clear answer personally. Yeah,
that's true. No, I completely agree. I think we probably would not see one app, but probably we'll see like maybe hundreds of apps, right? Maybe each with 1 million or maybe 10 million users. And eventually someday we'll get to 1 billion, hopefully. And then, yeah, like you said, with the UX, losing money is a very big deal. You know, if it's a bit small money, I think people can forget, but big money, it will escape you away and not come back ever, right?
And
security, like you said, that's a very big deal in Web3,
I mean, but I guess Linea is like a step towards that, right? Like also expensive. Yeah. Like what's the barrier to entry with regards to like paying? Like paying 20 USD for gas for me is like, okay, I can do it. I don't like it, but like I can do it. But like 20 USD for gas for like somebody who lives somewhere where 20 USD is a lot of money. Like that's not accessible at all, right?
Yeah, 20 USD is too much. I think sometimes that's how much certain people earn in a day. In some developing country, right? Yeah, it's like spending your whole like paycheck for the whole day for that. Yeah, so it's not a fun experience to have for sure.
Exactly.
I see. Yeah, just two more questions before we close out. Do you have any advice for people who want to break into Web3?
People who want to break, I mean, like, I think I was very fortunate in terms of my personal journey because I lived with someone who was already in Web3, and then I was also kind of entering Web3 at the height of a bull market, so people were very like interested in hiring anyone regardless of experience. But I think now, and like a lot of how I've seen my coworkers enter the space is through just education and community. So things like listening to your podcast, obviously, and getting a lot of insight into understanding, you know, how things work, be able to articulate like why you want to work into Web3 is like really important when it comes to, I guess, job applications and like working for existing Web3 companies, but also like demonstrating that through your actions as well. So not only being knowledgeable, but like the cool thing about Web3, right, is there's so many open communities that you can get involved with right away, right? Like we have DAOs or just like simple Telegram groups and other stuff like that that immediately give you access to resources and ability, like opportunities to be involved. So I would just say that, right? Like dive in, go to hackathons if you're a developer. That's a fantastic way to like build both a repertoire of work, meet talented people both from like a developer perspective as well as like other companies, and also just like get your hands on and actually like building, like writing a Solidity contract for an actual application.
Completely agree. I think the building part of it is so much fun, and actually I think that's what kind of got me into Web3 anyway officially. And then final question, where can people follow you and all your company? Feel free to share any public handles.
I mean, so for me specifically, my Twitter handle is _EMJLIN, so MJ Lin. But if you want to follow like Linea or Consensus, Linea is at Linea Build, LineaBuild. Consensus is just CONSENSYS. It's Consensus, but like the U is a Y. So don't be fooled. Don't follow Consensus with a U. But yeah, that's kind of where you can access all of us.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, make sure to put those links down in the show notes so people can follow you as well. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Emily. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for letting me wax poetically about D&D and other things that aren't necessarily related.
It's actually super fun to learn about D&D, actually. I never actually got to, you know, you gave a very good introduction to it too.
Awesome.
Thank you. And we're back to my studio. Did you guys enjoy this episode with Emily Lin? I think whichever room Emily steps into, she would certainly brighten up the room. I really enjoy learning about Dungeons & Dragons from her. It sounds like a game that I like partaking. She's also such a good evangelist. So she was able to explain a lot about Linea and the technology behind the ecosystem. It's actually quite a very interesting ecosystem, and I do think that it will grow a lot in the future. During the episode, I did mention a book about the founders of Ethereum. It's called The Cryptopians by Laura Shin. I've left a link in the show notes below for those who are interested. For the next episode, we'll be talking to Ivan Miskovic, the founder of MultiVM.io, a VM agnostic Ethereum rollup. It's a technical conversation, but it's also very interesting, and you don't want to miss it. Once again, thank you for listening, and see you next time.